Actually, Kagul, and I'm chairing this first talk that is called What is Experimental? A brief parenthesis, il talk sarà in inglese, perché entrambi i moderatori parleranno in inglese, non è stato segnalato all'esterno, però ci tengo a dirlo. So, What is Experimental is a talk that is developing two different moments, today and tomorrow at the same time here at the meeting point. And it started as a moment to from Artissima to really reflect on what is experimental and what is happening now in different parts of the world in terms of experimentation. And it was really something that is very felt by Artissima as a fair that has always been very inspired by trying to be at the giving at the moment or like feedback on what is happening. And so the first talk that is going to be happening today now, it's really bringing together two curators, one producer and curator, and one associate curator that will give you an example or like a view on what is happening in two different geographical area, and particularly Los Angeles and Shanghai. I'm here, in fact, joined by Surab Mohabi and Davide Quadrio. Surab Mohabi graduated at Bard College at the curatorial course and has worked at the Queen's Museum and Hammers Museum and is now associate curator at the Red Cup in Los Angeles. While Davide Quadrio was an Italian, has been for almost 30 years in China, in Beijing, and he, no, Shanghai, sorry, of course, and he has initiated Bizarre Space from 1998 to 2010, and then he has initiated a Heart Up that is a production curatorial platform together with other curators that is developing projects between Shanghai and Hong Kong, and is also curator at the Aurora Museum in Shanghai. When we think, when we are thinking about what is experimental also, it was really like trying to understand things that are happening outside the traditional frameworks. And artists and curators, especially after the global crisis of 2008, have been quite interested in exploring ways of doing things differently, and also putting into question how you can move around what looks like the traditional structure of a system, but also how sometimes the very art world systems can collapse in their traditional way of making things, or like the traditional way of providing conditions for artists and curators and critics to operate. So experimental also is always something referring to failure, so it's something that we would like also to explore to possible failure or things that can be done without having an outcome that has to be like confirmed. And that's also often happening in not necessarily within institution or a more institutional framework, but also in other more non-profit or also commercial galleries sometimes are like willing to take risk. And what is experimental also, we could also think in terms of like experiments that are necessarily happening in a scientific way, in a very neutral or like aseptic, let's say, environment, and so we were trying to see instead people that were really like putting into question this kind of neutrality, or like trying to relate it to life conditions, also like the relationship with the context, their own practice. So I would like now to give to Surab to start the presentation. We decided to organize this talk in two presentations of roughly 20 minutes each, and then we will have a discussion that is also open to the public. We started slightly late because of the Philly Prize that was a bit delayed, so after that there will be the Lectio Magistralis by Thomas Bayerle, and so you're more than welcome also to stop by. So,
Well, first of all, I want to thank you so much for inviting me and have this opportunity to be here with you and Davide. This is really great to be here. Thanks, Artissima. So the way that I'm going to this kind of talk is roughly about how both artists and institutions kind of experiment with space. And the way I wanted to present is really mainly through the work of Los Angeles-based artist John Knight, and who I organized his exhibition at RepCat in April of 2016. And John Knight's practice for is really an artist who always basically worked in situ. So that means that his every project of his will be some kind of experiment with the institutional context or with the space. And he usually grounds the project in a sort of broader social economic conditions of where it's located. So for his project at RepCat, I'm just going to go through a little bit of present a little bit of information about the institution to then be able to talk about John's work, and then mainly I'm going to take you guys through a tour of downtown Los Angeles art scene to some extent, let's say a very, obviously, not complete, but something. So RepCat is part of California Institute of the Arts, and was it opened in 2003, and they basically bottom of the Frank Gehry Los Angeles Disney Hall. And here I have a map, but it's not really that clear. I guess you can't see, but to the that kind of dot is where RepCat is. So it doesn't have to sort of glorify, facade of the Grand Avenue, but it's still within the same complex. When it opened, in front of it was a kind of a vacant lot that now is the new Broad Museum. And there's also further down on Grand Avenue is also the Museum of Contemporary Art. So that kind of like gives us a little bit of context. When John started thinking about the project, he had multiple ideas, and all of them somehow related to both this history of RepCat, but also the developments in downtown LA. So this is LA MoCA. This is the newly opened Broad Museum, and you can see in the back the Disney Hall. It's a very nice shot. Anyway, so this I just wanted to say the RepCat was basically in the parking lot of the Disney Hall. And as you can see in this photo, this is basically the hard hat tour of the parking lot. When the building was about to open, there was still, RepCat did not exist. So it was a very kind of last addition. It was almost like an afterthought. The reason it's there is that CalArts was founded by Disney to become an animation school, but eventually it became one of the most important experimental art schools. But they always wanted to have a presence in downtown LA, and finally, because CalArts' relation with the Disneys, and they managed to sort of negotiate to carve out basically a bunch of the parking lot and turn it into the space. As you can see, there's still like row G. It was basically about to open, and cars were about to park there, where they poured the concrete and decided to turn it into our space. So then, this is our parking lot. I just wanted to take you to RepCat through the lot. So this is the main lobby. Okay. This slide, I don't know if you guys can really see the slides, but this is a part of John's work where he inserted a slide in this slideshow that we have that announces the program. So what he did that basically inserted this photograph from 66 or 67, where Bunker Hill was nothing but basically the bulldozers are out, the housing that structure that already existed there and to develop it into kind of more of a commercial center of Los Angeles. So, and you can see that little, you know, this car, and this used to be kind of a parking lot. So it takes us to John's project, which basically the idea was to take the gallery back to its initial function through this intervention, so somehow turning it back into a parking lot, albeit a different kind. So he used the font that was also used in the lot, as you can see, and it's Bruce Mao designed this font for the concert hall, and it's a proprietary font that we managed to get the permission to use it. As you can see, he also painted used the same lavender color that was used in the parking lot, and the columns were painted again the same color, but with row G, which was originally it was going to be row G of the parking lot. I'm not going to really talk about the language that much. So take it from the top. Obviously, it's some kind of reference to the concert hall and the kind of music rehearsals, but also kind of pointing out to some of the institutional structures there. He also put out around Red Cat. There is this I forgot what you call this kind of bottom of the wall. So he took this out. So that was basically to try to again delineate the space and sort of make sure that we're now stepping into this gallery, which was the parking lot. And it also wanted to point out to how Frank Gehry basically did very, very little to change this. It was almost just to put that there and kind of put in the ceiling. That's pretty much it. Just go through a few slides of this project, and then we're going to go out of Red Cat. So this photo is from 2006 or 2005, I don't remember, but Raphael, who is our photographer, took this photo before the Eli Broad Museum was built, so that was built later here. So this was right across Red Cat. And Broad Museum opened last year. It's a private collection of Eli Broad, and who was also on the sort of board of Museum of Contemporary Art, and then through a series of incidents that he decided that he's going to open his own museum right across Museum of Contemporary Art. So the idea was that he would somehow try to, after Mogo went through some institutional crisis, that he kind of almost wanted to take over the institution. That didn't really happen. He managed to build his own museum just across the street. So then I think that we're going to go a little bit further downtown and now they're announced the opening of a new museum. So now there's going to be a museum called the Main Museum, which is going to open on Main Street and 4th. And this is a very particular, again, part of downtown LA. This is, I don't know if you can see it, but it's like the architecture rendering looks like kind of like a, I guess, alien landing sort of situation. And they have started to do some programming under the guise of Beta Main, which is mainly like it's going to be like a project space. I think what's important about this now going from kind of Bunker Hill to downtown LA, I think it's important to say that this is also where a lot of housing, I mean, a lot of homeless people live there, but also it's where, kind of for the past decades, it's always been a place that provides services for people who are the homeless or used to be homeless, so there's a lot of hotels there that turn into housing units for them. And also, because it was affordable, a lot of artists used to live there and still have studios there. It's kind of almost the heart of downtown. And where Bethel Main is opening, or Main Museum is opening, in fact, used to be called the Thieves' Corner, which was on the corner of Main and Fifth, so this is a block south of the Thieves' Corner. But the Main Museum is funded, again, by one person, so similar to Eli Broad that started his own museum. Main is again funded by this gentleman, and it's at the stage that is now. It has opened a project space, and this project space is mainly showing. So I can just like show you that the first project that they opened is with the LA artist Suzanne Lacey and Andrew Bowers, and the idea was that Suzanne Lacey will teach Andrew Bowers performance art through in a period of 10 days. Suzanne Lacey and Andrew Bowers are both really known for their sort of social practice, which kind of usually involves a lot of projects with different communities. And here, it seems like, again, it's happening in the museum and in a development that is owned by one of the developers that is one of the main people responsible for the displacement of a lot of people in downtown LA. And obviously, the opening of this museum will make it even more difficult as they basically real estate values are going higher and higher. And in fact, through this kind of social practice activities, they're creating value at this institution by artists who are technically making work that is concerned about the communities that they kind of try to engage with. And I think what's interesting that for this project happening here is that almost there's no mention of what that neighborhood used to be known for. And we're just starting to have a new museum there. And then I just wanted to show you like a small picture of this is what Skid Row looks at night, and this is a very clean night, probably, and I just didn't want to show you a lot of other people's pictures from Skid Row, but you can obviously look it up on the internet. And I was just going to try to finish with this one last slide. And over the past 35 years, John Malpeet has been working with the Los Angeles Poverty Department, which is a theater group that is mainly with composed of homeless or formerly homeless people who are part of the LA Poverty Department. And now they started their own museum, which is in proximity to the Main Museum. It's almost a few blocks up north of it on Broadway, between 4th and 5th, so not that far. And the idea behind this museum is to show the history of the community has been living in Skid Row, and that obviously includes, you know, activists and neighborhood organizers and other people who have contributed one way or another. Because there are Christian missions over there, there's housing units over there, there's many different kind of facilities that are used for the homeless. And so the history, the Los Angeles Poverty Department's Skid Row History Museum and Archive is a project that is archiving the activities of all these people in the past 30, 35 years. So it provides a pretty comprehensive information about a lot of community leaders and activists who've been there. And they also do a lot of theater pieces and but mainly, they try to turn this museum in as a place where this history becomes kind of available to the visitors. And I think this kind of I just wanted to go from kind of different kind of institutional sort of activities, a new museum from up kind of north Bunker Hill to down to Maine, where this is now kind of becoming the heart of LA, I guess, emerging museum scene. I think I'm going to maybe stop here and go to Stamida, and maybe we can go to Shanghai and see how things are happening over there.
Okay, thanks a lot, Surab.
Thank you, Surab. I think it's good that you stop there and I start from there, actually, because your west is my east, actually, and we only have the Pacific in the middle. And it's interesting because what I'm going to show you is, I'm going to put this slideshow on. Can you start from the beginning, please? So I will start, actually, I'm going to put this in a sort of a never-ending loop. So you're going to see from the 1998 to now, the change of the cultural landscape in Shanghai. It's going to be difficult to absorb all the images, so I decided to just let it go like that. So after five or six times, you're going to see the same images, probably going to, you know, have some revelations. So I start from where you left. It's basically in 1998 when I started my first experience there together with a collective. The art scene in Shanghai was basically very, very small, extremely small. Well, only one gallery that we can call international gallery is called Shang Art in 1997. And then in 1998, we opened Biz Art, which is Biz and Art. And then it already gives you the I can say the temperature of what to do art and culture in China was at that time. It was not public programming, it was not public fund, there was not money because the big money was not still made. It's less than 20 years ago, yet it looks to me like we're talking about something that is my grandfather, sort of, you know, the Dado Senior, Davide Senior, you know, talking about. And so basically the space that we opened was going around the city, was, you know, interfering with the locality that it was actually being destroyed, you know, while we were doing. The first spaces were, including the gallery spaces, they're actually been moving every 3 to 4 months. We were expert in finding amazing warehouses on the back of restaurants, and then using that, you know, like for 3 months, and then moving somewhere else. The first time that actually all the art scene came together in what is called Mogangshan Number 50 or M50 was in the year 2001, when basically at the same time, like four at that time, there was already like four major galleries and our space. Find ourselves without the space because they were all pulled down, and so we had to find, you know, a new venue that is M50 is still active in a way. So we moved all together, and it was the start of a fantastic moment where nobody actually was really caring about Shanghai and China. So we were developing whatever we wanted, making all the fantastic mistakes. Creating and, you know, dismantling, working with artists everywhere. There was this kind of casuality of creativeness that, which is still now beautiful. I give you some numbers to you just that you understand the scale, because I think the West doesn't really know what happened there in 10 years yet. And we are actually we've been called in New York by a museum to present a work for next year. Actually, we're going to present it in October in New York, and it's basically what happened, you know, from the end of the 90s to 2010 in Shanghai. And only in the space that we were collectively curating and producing, we had 280 exhibitions in 10 years, and we presented 440 artists. We had shows that were lasting like 2 days because we didn't have money to do it. So anyway, it's been an amazing thing. And then from 2004 to now, we are assisting to an amazing booming of actually institutional infrastructure that look like that, actually. But they are all private. So there is a sort of, you know, commonality with what you were saying before, and it's of course a fantastic to have beautiful spaces that you can see here, fantastic architectures, amazing art platforms, basically. But at the same time, what really implies and how these are curated and how are somehow more and more distracted from the locality and getting into this international game that doesn't have much to do with Shanghai and its own development, but it becomes like a sort of global player sort of role. So all that, of course, there are fantastic experiences, and you know it's beautiful to have Jeffrey Deitch, you know, showing or creating a show in Shanghai that never happened before, or Hans Ulbricht, you know, coming along and do a Shanghai project that didn't have anything to do with Shanghai actually, but the name, because it was not, you know, somehow connected to anybody really working there. So it was like, you know, a UFO transported into Shanghai for 2 weeks and fantastic efflux and amazing people coming, but really, you know, we don't know why. There is, of course, an incredible now art scene that involves galleries and young local galleries that is also a very recent phenomenon of the last 6 years. Before that, including myself, we are basically many foreigners, you know, sort of this kind of hybrid, cultural, strange beings being there for many, you know, for many years and completely involved in the strata of the city, but at the same time being foreigners, so bringing, you know, a very different sort of eye and perception of what should have been done there. Now we have like fantastic young galleries, amazing people with a lot of energy, you know, creating a very different way of connecting to the city, but at the same time becoming completely global. So that's a bit of the scene of things that's happening now. Concerning me, from, you know, we had a, you know, we were very small places, and we, you know, we became like an institution for 10 years, having, you know, like basically 1,500 meters squared of space, and it was completely only self-supported with the biz side. So we were doing a lot of businesses and not really selling the art, because whatever we did there was not sellable, actually. But doing really services to big companies and getting in contact with what is actually happening more and more in Europe. You know, like public funding is not here anymore, or very little, and so you need to find alternative ways of supporting yourself. So we've been doing in the early 2000s, you know, doing design work. We were doing public art, very shitty one actually, and then, you know, but it was the money, you know, that was actually coming into us, into this kind of, you know, bubble of private, public, you know, art creation. And then we were doing a lot of sponsorship, looking for sponsorship and having like this kind of very sort of, really getting so close to the economy of, you know, or really the real economy, you know, the real companies doing things, but at the same time understanding more and more how they work and how they and what they want. And so actually trying in that kind of negotiation to keep, you know, your sort of ethical and honesty, but then at the same time engaging with that and not refusing that, which has been extremely complicated, but is a fantastic model that I feel a survival of. You know? Of course, a lot of people, some of the, you know, even today, a lot of people, they ask me again, you know, so bizarre, so you were a dealer, you know, and I was like, and I'm like, the fact that you work with companies or with a private, you know, sort of sector doesn't mean that you become a dealer per se. You know, actually, you become your own sponsor, and you become, you know, you create your own zone of production that nobody can touch. So that gave us an incredible freedom of doing whatever we wanted. So from that kind of, you know, environment, then we became more and more, you know, I say we because the community was so small that we were like, I don't know, 30 people with the artists working in this field, and then now we are maybe 100 or 150 tops in a city of 25 million people. So it's still a very sort of small community, and we know each other, and there is this amazing, actually, collaboration between the different parties and different levels of institutions and private sector. So from that, then we became, you know, from an underground phenomenon, we are now more and more, and all the museums that you see here as well, connected with the municipality of Shanghai that has an interest of having us as translator of what is contemporary in China. So there is this fantastic and incredible new tendency of having what was considered as a resistance and also as a problematic sort of platform becoming actually part of the establishment, but also really in a sort of cynical but I think interesting way, we become also part of this new generation of what China wants to say about itself, you know, and I found that this kind of engagement with the evil, you know, like somehow a very interesting, disturbing at times, but very fruitful collaboration. Said that, you know, what's happening now is that there is a lot of commission and mixture of what is the product of the art and what is the production. So there are more and more galleries, actually they work in a very different way than galleries in Europe and in the States. One of the examples at which actually I invited also to the fair here and invite you to maybe engage with them is Meidin. Meidin is actually an artist, Su Zhen, was my partner at BizArt for 10 years, and then we split, as Stefano was saying. I decided to go more on no space, no management, you know, like production, extending things when needed, but otherwise being really sort of a, you know, hanging platform. And Su Zhen, as an artist, a fantastic artist actually, to get engaged more and more on his own work, but also creating something that is also in the tradition of the Western art history, but somehow very innovative in China, that is becoming a warehouse, a working force, which is an artist, a company, a gallery, a fashion brand, and now actually also a shop, which opens today actually, so I don't know how it looks like. So as you were saying, you know, this kind of return to create things that are smaller in a way, very, very contaminated by the overall commercial environment that China represents. I think it's not a, you know, liberalism in China, it went so far that actually did the 360 degrees and back. And at the same time, in the case of, you know, what I'm doing there, for instance, I shrink and everything to the point that the space that the government gives me now, which, by the way, is in an office building that they open for creative businesses in the heart of Shanghai. So they gave me this space, which I use as a not-for-profit sort of situation, and I reduce everything to a table. It's called exhibition on a table. So we have like 4 meters square of a space, which is a common space for people working there. So 3 floors of, I don't know, like 300 people working there, and they actually can use this space as an office, which is of actually the exhibition, which is actually the project that we are doing. So all that is part of what's happening now. The not-for-profit is not existing anymore in a way. There is no need for that. And I think that even myself, you know, coming from a very strong idealistic background in that sense, in China is not possible anymore because simply there are no structures that allow you to do that. And so if you try to do a not-for-profit that it was possible when we started because of the economical situation and how cheap it was to live and to work and to create things, in China now it's completely past. spaces are extremely expensive, life is extremely expensive. There is still very little money dedicated to production and art in the public sector, but also in the private one. And so that actually doesn't allow us what we can, you know, in the Western world think as a not-for-profit situation to occur. But there is a lot of not-for-profit, of course, you know, energy in the way that things are done. So, and I mean, I just stop here just to give a bit of that. So I open to a conversation if you want to. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Davide, and thank you both for your presentation. I think it's very interesting. I would like just now to do a couple of questions, and then I'm very happy if the public also has some comments or they want to ask questions. So feel free also to intervene. But the relationship that both of you had were like outlining with the private sector being involved more and more with production and like creation of spaces that are like supposed to be public but at the same time are like dealing with conditions of space that are gentrified and changing and transforming in the urban landscape. So I was also wondering if you could analyze or explore a bit more the relationship with the public. In, for example, I'm very curious to understand how, for example, the city of LA or the downtown area, in terms also of politics, are like interfacing with the Skid Row Museum, for example, or with a project like John Knight. So if you had any feedback in terms of his gesture and his exhibition, if it provoke any kind of debate also on a political level, that would be interesting. And then also, David, if you could also maybe explore more or tell us more about how also the relationship with politics in China is happening, and in terms of content and in terms also of support for the artists, for example, how that fits.
I guess that's a good question. I can answer it in kind of a couple of different ways. One is important to say that, yes, there has been a lot going on right now, in fact, in LA, in terms of suddenly this kind of realization that, you know, we're used to go around and say, oh, art is like inconsequential, and, you know, we kind of try to get away with that kind of indeterminacy. But it has a lot of power, and I think, in fact, I feel what we can do right now is to acknowledge that this power exists, and then see how we can use it, because it's always framed the other way around. And I think now there's more and more moments that you realize that people are also realizing that that power exists, and it transforms communities for the better. It can also uproot them. So, in fact, in LA now there's a growing gallery scene in the same downtown area where there a new nonprofit recently opened called FIST, and it became extremely controversial. There was a lot of protest, and it was in the neighborhood of Boyle Heights, which is adjacent to downtown, and so it opened up a lot of conversation about what is the role of this and these spaces, what do they do? Not only in terms of like the people who come and go, but also how it affects the neighborhood, the fabric of the community, but also like culturally what it does. So in a way, yes, there it's becoming more and more a kind of a conversation that we hear about a lot. With Eli Broad's situation, it's a little different because that was already a part of downtown that have been developed. So the new museum was built, and there are lines in front of road, and it's going. You know, it's a very blue chip sort of kind of museum. Main Museum is different. Main Museum is really at the center of Skid Row. So, I mean, not at the center of Skid Row, but almost there. It's really kind of, we've been witnessing in the past few years how the development in downtown has completely, the rent has gone up so much that it's not even, I mean, I don't think like the word gentrification is actually works anymore. Gentrification used to be a process. This is no longer a process. This is like, here we go, you know, we're here, you have to pay like this much money, that this is going to happen. It's very different. So, but I think what's happening with LA, I feel at least you can see that there is a bit more of the fact that people are acknowledging that art is a force and how we're going to deal with that. And I think it's not only the public, but also I feel like doesn't matter. I mean, like I feel funders, galleries, artists, and the public, we need to decide that what kind of art world and what kind of a city we want to live in. Is it going to be a city where we have a bunch of blue chip museums and kind of like upper middle class sort of activities? I mean, there are so many restaurants there. I mean, end up, as Citro Style kind of said, like, homeless people are basically can eat art there now. You know, there's so much art production in downtown LA. But it's that which what we want, or, and I think, but by opening up these conversations, I think it's important to see that actually art world has this power, and you know, we are in the context of an art fair where we can see that these forces can actually have different outcomes. One could be what happens in the Main Museum through what I can say, like they're weaponizing social practice to displace people, which is like kind of the definition of irony. But on the other hand, I mean, you can have the same kind of conversations and making it happen in a way that might be more useful for the well-being of the community. I think like the hybrid models that you were talking about, in fact, in LA, we're having more and more like trying to figure out how these models could work for everyone, not for just, you know, very few people.
Right. Ask you about if you tell us more about John Knight show, the kind of response that you had.
That's a different. Okay. In terms of John's show, I feel it was in a way it really was became a conversation about different kind of sides of, let's say, the CalArts community on the one hand, because it was kind of looking at our institution somewhat historically. It was well received in terms of reviews in LA Times, but I think in terms of the political perception, I don't think there was that much. I don't think it was people started saying, oh, now, you know, I mean, kind of, I guess one of the fundamental ideas behind the project was the fact that you know, there's a relation between space, architecture, and value, and parking lots were valued. In the 70s, they destroyed a theater in downtown, built a parking lot. Now, parking lots are becoming art institutions. So we have the Broad, Red Cat itself was a parking lot. So he was kind of like, proposing this relationship between the space, architecture, and how it generates value. I think in a way that was kind of received and discussed, but not in a way that, create any specific conversation about that specific location.
I talk about Shanghai because talking about China is too much. I mean, it's impossible. You're talking about so different speeds and places and cultural references as well, because if you talk about Hong Kong or Canton versus Beijing or Shanghai, you know, Wuhan, or Chengdu, they're so different places that it's impossible. So I try to keep it very connected to what it is, also because Shanghai has been always a very special place, in the sense that it's been, from the beginning, a place considered also by institutions in China as the Western place. So it's always been considered as the window for the West and for the rest of the world to see the grandness of the futuristic idea of what China can become, while of course Beijing is the, you know, the center of the power, and then is being designed and figured out in a very different way.
It's very difficult for me always to talk about, Shanghai, because there are so many problems in translating, you know, like the speed, the intensity, and the complexity of the political, social, and economical structure that's been put in place in 20 years. And it's very difficult to explain that because I don't think that, you know, in our generation, European states, we've been able to experience such a thing, you know, and the complexity of being not in a country of only a few million people, but actually have been in a trillion or whatever population, you know, where countryside, you know, urban places are so different and so dramatically complex. And one of the reasons why, for instance, I'm here in Turin, because I created this show, it's called Around Ai Weiwei in Camera, was also, and I accepted it as a show, not because I'm a fan of the artist, but actually because I think it's interesting to try in the West now to also think and to show the complexity of the development of that, you know, through a key figure in the West like Ai Weiwei is, you know, because we cannot go against that. But also how that is a symbolic sort of misinterpretation of an artist, the value of a, you know, of a social activist, you know, in the context of China and in the West. So the show is on, so you can actually check it. That there is basically not one monumental. There is not an artwork of Ai Weiwei in the show. There are only like very simple, very small and extremely curated pieces that few people, I think, saw. But everything is about the documentation of this figure in the context of development of Beijing, in that case, you know, that it was somehow reflected to in Shanghai to what I was saying just now. So it's complicated because it's never linear in China. It's been always like this moment of openness and closeness. We are in a moment now that is extremely dramatic and extremely strange how the authorities are actually controlling the culture and in social issues. It's a very delicate moment. It's very difficult to, again, sorry if I repeat myself and, you know, saying that it's difficult to explain, but it is. Because when, if you go to Shanghai now, you walk the streets, it seems like everything and it's normal. But then if you really work there, then there are much more complicated, you know, like rules of behavior, really, in whatever you do. So it's always contradictory what I'm, you know, when I talk about this, and, you know, it's always a contradiction because on the one side, it is true. On the other side, I don't know, I've been called to sit on the board now of the Shanghai Municipality for International Exchange. So, and it's like, why now and not 5 years ago? So it's very difficult to really give only an answer of what the political situation, how the government is actually interfering or supporting, you know, and because it's also so Confucianist, you know, so every, from the top to the bottom, you know, there are so different sort of pyramids, you know, of power and little bubbles, you know, that they work in a different way. And so it's very difficult to say, for instance, there is, you know, Pudong area, which is the new area developed in the last 20 years, is extremely open to public art and, you know, and theater and stuff like that because they want to have that kind of, you know, new and international, while other parts of the cities are very much more cautious in what they do. There is, I was saying, an incredible mingling between government, real estate developers, role of the real estate developers becoming the supporter of culture, so that the government is pushing and it gives as a request to real estate developers that whatever they do, they need to give back to the community through cultural environment, cultural situations that can be, you know, gardens, theaters, whatever. So there is this kind of over appearance, you know, of cultural institutions which are private, they don't have any kind of structure, they don't know how to deal with that. the last one, for instance, I didn't show here, is by Wanker, which is one of, I mean, he's the biggest real estate developer in the world. And they just opened, you know, this new museum. They actually want to open it now, and then they have two 25 years old ladies as directors of that, and they don't know what to do with that. They, you know, they want to open with a huge show. It's 10,000 meters square of an exhibition space, and they want to open in 2 months. And so you're like, what are you going to do? So it's all this kind of contradictory thing that you have fantastic spaces, beautiful, amazing, you know, possibilities, but then the software is not there or is not even considered as necessary, because actually the space, talking about the space and the building, are much more, of course, politically appealing than having, you know, a fantastic program that, I don't know, that is going to be socially engaged, for instance. Why? So the space is there, it's okay. So, but I invite you, if you have the chance, to come to Shanghai, because it's really like a fantastic sort of, you know, trip, really. In a, and, it, you know, the complexity there is, it's complicated, but it's fascinating. Please.
How much leverage do you have? I mean, you're in the committee, and how much leverage do you have?
I don't know, because I've literally just been appointed, and I'm like...
it's a bit of a dubious situation, but how do you work with that dubious situation? Do you
It's always extremely interesting to work with. I mean, I never... even if you think about it, I mean, you know, when I opened the show about Ai Weiwei, you know, of course nobody here thinks that if I go back now to China next week, I can be questioned or I can be also, you know, retired my visa. I don't know, you know. What I've been always doing, and probably is also why I've been surviving so long, is that whatever I've been doing, even the more, you know, extreme things that we did, it was always open. So the moment that there was a problem, they're human beings. Also, you know, like the censorship thing, they're human beings. So they don't want to have trouble. So they want to talk to you, so that you find a solution in the middle. And then, so I turned out, for instance, for a few years to have every six months, you know, a fantastic dinner with, you know, the censorship bureau, where you talk about what I'm gonna do, and, you know, what is okay to do, and, you know, very nice, and then, you know, you drink tea, you know. But they're human beings, so, you know, it's always about that kind of, you know, relationship. Being Italian actually works. Yeah. I don't know. I think there is all this kind of, you know, mafia
negotiation,
or mafia, whatever. One of the two together.
I have another quick question that is more related to the idea of history. Also, that it was interesting that the Los Angeles Poverty Department funded, for example, a Skid Row History Museum. And now I have the feeling that instead a lot of art, and that was happening in the 70s, you say?
Right, yeah.
Well, now I have the feeling that a lot of artists or even curators, when they're like confronting their own, let's say, no-profit, for example, spaces, or that they are like having another kind of temporality in mind for what they're doing. If they're funding institutions or like space that are like trying to provide a support for the artist, while in this case it was the idea of giving a history to the future that was at the core of the Skid Row History Museum and the Los Angeles Poverty Department. And on the other side, we have commercial spaces that are in downtown opening almost museum-like situations in LA, for example. And then I was also wondering how history is built. That with this non-existing non-profit space that you were saying, that becomes more like enterprises or like other kind of like companies, let's say. So if you could maybe give some thoughts about this, because this is also somehow highlighting a transformation in the idea of what can be done in a kind of more experimental,
right.
No, especially with these new big museums that are opening in an area that has been like that.
Well, I mean, obviously, like, history is something that we make. It's something made up. And I think all these, what LAPD is trying to do is to present a history that didn't exist, so contribute in that way and kind of make that more visible. In fact, I would say the history that, let's say, Eli Broad or the Broad Museum is presenting is a history that's already written. It's a very heterosexual white male kind of history of American art, and that's mainly what the collection is. Not everything, but that's mainly the sort of like blue chip. Every kind of contemporary art book, art now that you open will have like some Christopher Wool or whatever. So that's the kind of direction that history. I don't think I think what I can add to that is that is the history that crushes other histories. So that's the problem. I mean, I don't think the issue is that museum, like such museums exist. The issue is that it becomes more and more the dominant way of thinking about this one line, you know. I think what's interesting about something like LA Poverty Department is that it is, since they've been there for so long, like everyone from Paul McCarthy to Barbara T. Smith to Simone Forti, all of these people, they're all one community, they all knew each other. So, for instance, LA Poverty Department has a gallery, it's the Box Gallery, which I think is one of the most important galleries in Los Angeles. They show them. So this is a history that also is being preserved, presented by one part of LA art community. And I think it's also important to say that LA was a place where it was always the fantasy of space. So we'd go there, and an artist had a lot of space. So that's what allowed, let's say, Mike Kelly or Paul McCartney or Jason Rhodes, all those people make the work that they did. They had the possibility to do it. And what's happening is that if that's the history that we want to preserve, then I don't think the artists can, young artists that are kind of trying to build up their career in LA have a harder time to kind of be able to experience with space like that. Mm-hmm. And that kind of work is becoming harder and harder to do. Obviously, capital both opens up space but also limits space. So that's the negotiation that's happening. I think like these are kind of three points about history. I don't know if that made any sense. Yeah.
I would say that there are not actually independent art spaces, let's say, or not-for-profit, which is true and not true. So it's complicated because, as you were saying, the models of creativity changes really with the environment, you know, and the social, economic, and political environment around it. So it's interesting to see that in a sort of medium term, like 15 years of China. So it's like how, you know, be a not-for-profit was a status that it was required because there was no other possibilities in the end of the 90s and beginning of 2000, then how it became immediately or gallery business, and then there are some, you know, moments of resistance in a way, you know, but then because there are, you cannot really register as a not-for-profit entity, for instance, in China. You cannot, and since last year, actually, you cannot even be, register as that in Hong Kong, because Hong Kong had always like a very different sort of status, even though it's part of China. So our club, for instance, as a not-for-profit, was registered as such in Hong Kong. I'm still there, I don't know for how long, but actually they can close me down because it's not legal anymore. So there are this kind of situation that is complicated to, again, sorry to repeat the same thing, but to explain in a sort of linear language that everybody can understand. Said that, each of, you know, for instance, in publishing the last few years, there have been amazing episodes of independent, you know, very precise, extremely beautiful projects in the queer community in Shanghai that is becoming stronger, and actually for me one of the most interesting sort of area of possible social resistance and cultural resistance in Shanghai and China at the moment. But also like publishing, for instance, there is it's called Jia Zha Zhi, which means fake magazine basically, and they do incredible publications. They produce a lot of limited, sometimes only like five, you know, an edition of five books, so very much like the art books. And then everything that is surrounding that is, you know, like a space for debate, for talking, you know, to create this kind of not-for-profit environment. So it's somehow becoming less about the space and more about the content, and then you occupy, you know, like the space that you want in the moment that you want. And it somehow, you know, strange enough, echo really reminds of the, you know, the 90s where actually you couldn't, you know, do otherwise. I don't have just comment on that. But maybe, we, you know, there are people that have questions instead of having only the three of us talking.
Yeah, we still have some minutes that we can open.
It's done. We are here if you want to talk to us.
No, it's true. We have now the Lectio Magistralis from Thomas Paerle, a passport, yeah? And tomorrow we will have another panel of What is Experimental with Toby Meyer and Natalia Siljevic at 3 o'clock. So I hope you will come back. Thank you for being here, and thank you, Davide, and for your presentation.